and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. Today is Friday, March 17, Happy St. Patrick's Day. From the front page of the Gazette today, Spring on Schedule is the title of the front page article, this by Aaron Jordan. While most Iowans long for spring, fruit growers like to see 30 and 40 degree temperatures through March because it lessens the odds a late cold snap will freeze buds or blooms. Right now, all the apple trees still are quite dormant, said Paul Rash, owner of Wilson's Orchard and Farm in Solon. We usually bloom that last week in April or first week in May, and that's really great for us if we can bloom later. Spring is right on track in Iowa, with daffodils and tulips expected to bloom in early to mid-April, and fruit trees flowering a few weeks later, said Patrick O'Malley, a Linn County-based commercial fruit and vegetable field specialist with Iowa State University Extension. A gradual warm-up is much better for trees, shrubs, and flowers, with the erratic swings in temperatures Iowa often gets in the spring. Trees and shrubs need between 1,000 and 2,000 chill hours between 32 and 40 degrees to go dormant in the winter. After that, they wait for average temperatures to rise above 50 degrees to start flowering. So if we have a freak 70 degree day and 40 degree night in February, those trees think it's spring. When the inevitable March or April frost hits, trees could lose their fruit-making potential for the year. Any cooler than normal temperatures are good this time of year, O'Malley said. A cloudy, cold day is great. That's one more day without having to worry about hard freezes down the road. Rash and Sarah Gehring bought Wilson's in 2009. 3 years later, in 2012, a warm winter caused trees to come out of dormancy early and bloom in mid-March. Then April hit with some overnight freezing temperatures and most of the apples died. At Wilson's, where we normally harvest about a million apples, we had less than 1,000, probably a few hundred, Rash said. Every fruit grower east of the Rocky Mountains will remember that with angst. Some large commercial growers use wind machines to mix warmer and cooler air to raise temperatures a few degrees to prevent an orchard freeze. That works for a night or two, but not when you've got a week or more of overnight frost, Rush said. Certain apple varieties serve as spring harbingers, he said. Ginger Gold ripens in late August, but it's always among our very first to get excited about flowering. Extreme weather, including hail, ice storms, floods, droughts, and windstorms, are becoming more common in Iowa with climate change. For the agriculture industry, this might mean getting more crop insurance or changing planting dates. For Wilson's, it means more anxiety. Wilson's plans to hold its second annual tulip festival in late April, and owners were a little worried when they saw shoots emerging earlier this month. Tulips have a 3-week window, and Wilson's didn't want the flowers to bloom before the festival. Last year, due to a cold April, it took about 40 days from sprouting to full bloom, but it could be as little as 20 with warmer weather. Wilson's posted on Facebook March 7, "We'll keep an eye out and keep updating as we get closer to nailing down a date for our second annual tulip festival." Then 4 inches of snow fell March 9 and 10, blanketing those early shoots. Flower growers needn't be worried about that snow. It actually protects flowers, O'Malley said. The snow acts as insulation, he said. If it's covering a plant, we'll keep it the temperature close to 32 degrees. If it gets to 20 degrees, the plant will still feel like 32. If plants had already flowered and temperatures dipped below 28 degrees, there may be some damage, O'Malley said. But just having a few inches of leaves exposed to the snow will not hurt the plants. The next 10 days look great for flowers, shrubs, and trees to bloom normally, he said. That's good news for Rash. Tulips are a very expensive crop to grow. You plant tens of thousands of bulbs per acre, and then you're holding your breath and hoping the weather holds, he said. But the reward of seeing every shade of tulips blooming along Rapid Creek in the orchard last year was worth it. It's quite a kaleidoscope. Also on the front page, this story by Isabella Zaluska. The city of Iowa City is planning to install 13 cameras throughout the pedestrian mall this summer, which the city says will help law enforcement by giving them access to footage when they are investigating incidents in the area. The new cameras will capture more than is currently available and will be the first city-owned cameras in the downtown pedestrian mall, city staff told the Gazette. The estimated project cost is $95,000. In some cases, our officers and investigators will have access to 360-degree coverage, which will be critical in instances such as a missing child or a fleeing subject, as our officers will be able to use that footage to more accurately track their movements through the Ped Mall when investigating the incident, Public Safety Information Officer Lee Hermiston said. The infrastructure for the cameras was installed a few years ago as part of the 2018-2019 Pedestrian Mall Improvements Project, Hermiston said. Communications Coordinator Shannon McMahon said the project was not prompted by any recent incident. Recent incidents on the Ped Mall include shots fired in 2021 and again in January this year. There have also been thefts reported, including a Christmas sleigh that was taken in November and an inflatable rabbit that was part of an art exhibit taken in February, both of which were ultimately returned. Hermiston said the cameras will not be used to actively monitor Ped Mall visitors and shoppers. Most of the time, the footage will be accessed after an incident, he said. When crime occurs in the pedestrian mall, Hermiston said the Iowa City Police Department has had to rely on private entities to provide camera footage. These cameras will provide us with our own footage to help make arrests and get convictions, as juries are increasingly expecting concrete, impartial evidence rather than just witness accounts, Hermiston said. The project went out for bid this week, and bids are due April 5. Turning to page 2, the Iowa Today page, this story by Trish Mahaffey is titled, Tame a Man Accused of Stabbing Man on Meskwaki Settlement. A Tame a Man is accused of stabbing another man multiple times last November during a fight at a house on the Meskwaki settlement. Victor Garcia, age 25, a member of the Sac and Fox tribe of the Mississippi, was indicted in U.S. District Court last month on one count of assault causing serious bodily injury. A federal judge ruled there was probable cause for the charge during a preliminary hearing last month. Garcia remains in jail pending trial. Garcia pleaded not guilty during his arraignment earlier this month, and a trial date is set for April 24. Garcia is accused of rapidly stabbing R.G., as identified in the indictment and complaint, November 5, 2022, at a house on Meskwaki Road within the settlement. When Meskwaki Nation police officers arrived, they found R.G. lying on the living room floor with multiple stab wounds and having trouble breathing, according to a criminal complaint. Officers said there was a large wound on his abdomen and they could see what appeared to be the victim's internal organs, the complaint stated. They gave him emergency first aid until medical personnel arrived. Multiple witnesses were at the scene and it was alleged that Garcia stabbed the man, according to the complaint. Witnesses said there was an argument between R.G. and his girlfriend. Garcia then stepped in to calm down R.G. and the men started fighting outside. The fight continued inside the house and Garcia went into the kitchen and grabbed a knife. One witness said the men were arguing in the kitchen and then tackled each other, the complaint stated. At one point, R.G. lunged at Garcia and then the two began to scuffle on the floor in the kitchen. Another witness told police that R.G. told Garcia to stop multiple times. According to the complaint, R.G. was taken to the hospital and underwent surgery. While in the hospital, R.G. confirmed to officers that Garcia, who was not injured, stabbed him. R.G. remained in the hospital for about 5 days, and part of his stay was in the intensive care unit. Officers searched the house following the stabbing. They found a large amount of blood on the kitchen floor and a large knife covered in blood. If convicted, Garcia would face up to 10 years in federal prison. And also on the Iowa Today page, felony charge dropped against Cedar Rapids woman, this by Trish Mahaffey. A prosecutor dismissed charges earlier this month against a Cedar Rapids woman who was charged with abandonment of her 2-year-old and 9-month-old children who were left alone while she went to work. Zuena Rambo, age 25, was charged with abandonment of a dependent person last year, and 3 cases involving Rambo and her children were also opened in juvenile court, according to court documents. Assistant Linn County Attorney Mike Harris, in his motion to dismiss, said Rambo had complied with the conditions set in those cases and cooperated with Department of Human Services and juvenile court regarding her children, so he was dropping the felony charge. Rambo has agreed to pay any court costs related to the case, Harris said. According to the criminal complaint filed in March 2022, Rambo left the children alone to go to work in a different city. A city housing inspector and a maintenance person at her apartment building found the children and contacted police. The children were left to fend for themselves and had no adult supervision, the complaint said. The 9-month-old was found eating a croissant roll with spoiled milk, face covered in mucus, in a room that smelled like urine. This story by Trish Mahaffey is titled, Former Iowa City Pride Leader Will Plead Next Month to Stealing Over $35,000. A former president and interim treasurer of Iowa City Pride will plead next week to stealing more than $35,000 by using the organization's debit card for personal bills, travel, restaurants, and making cash withdrawals in 2021. Anthony Sivanthafana, 37, of Iowa City, is charged with first-degree theft. He will plead April 17, but there is no information regarding his plea agreement in court documents. Sivanthafana, a former president who became interim treasurer in May 2021, after another member left the position, was issued a debit card linked to the organization's account, according to court documents. It was standard practice that the president and treasurer were issued cards and any purchases needed approved by the board. He also ordered checks in his own name using the Iowa City Pride account number, which wasn't authorized. In fall 2021, members of the organization were notified a payment to a staging vendor had bounced, which prompted an internal review of the accounting records. The audit showed many unauthorized transactions from May through November 2021, totaling $35,732. According to a criminal complaint, Sivanthafana used the LGBTQ's group funds at restaurants, retail, hotels, gas, travel, personal bills, and he made cash withdrawals. Many of the purchases were made outside of Iowa City or Iowa. Minneapolis, Minnesota, Columbus, Ohio, Kansas City and St. Louis, Missouri, Knoxville and Nashville, Tennessee, and Cedar Rapids. Sivanthafana's social media and email document his pattern of behavior, and he made admissions to his involvement in spending money without permission, the complaint states. According to a search warrant affidavit, Iowa City Pride members connected many of his social media posts, indicating he was visiting those locations at the time the purchases were made. During the investigation, Sivanthafana's cell phone was searched January 24, 2022, and he was also interviewed by investigators. He admitted to making the purchases, and he estimated spending around $8,000. Johnson County Attorney Rachel Zimmerman Smith filed an order of restitution to be paid to Iowa City Pride for $35,732. Court documents indicate that is part of the plea agreement, and 6th Judicial District Chief Judge Lars Anderson directed the clerk of court to accept pre-plea restitution payments. Sivanthafana served as president of Iowa City Pride from the fall of 2019 to December of 2021. Before that, he was on the organization's board for 8 years. This story by Tom Barton is titled, Iowa Passes Transgender Bathroom Restrictions for Schools. It's from the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. legislation that would prohibit transgender youth from using school bathrooms and locker rooms that correspond with their gender identity is headed to Republican Governor Kim Reynolds for her signature. The Iowa House voted 57 to 39 with five Republicans joining Democrats in opposition to pass Senate File 482. The legislation requires public schools to maintain separate bathrooms, locker rooms, showers, dressing areas, and overnight accommodations for biological boys and biological girls. Students wishing for greater privacy would need parental permission to request use of alternative facilities, such as a single occupancy or faculty bathroom or locker room. Schools would be required to evaluate such requests and, to the extent reasonable, offer options for alternative facilities. The bill states that schools cannot be punished for restricting bathrooms and locker rooms to members of the same biological sex. It also directs the Iowa Attorney General's Office to investigate complaints of alleged violations of the legislation and file action in court to seek equitable relief should it determine that legal action is warranted. Senate Republicans passed the bill last week, describing the proposal as a common-sense way to ensure the privacy and safety of all Iowa students. The issue addressed in this legislation at one point was not up for debate, but the goalposts have now been moved, said Representative Stephen Holt, Republican from Denison, the bill's floor manager. For many decades, schools have separated locker rooms and bathrooms and hotel rooms on school trips by biological sex. This is nothing new. Data, though, overwhelmingly shows that incidents of sexual assault in school bathrooms are rare, and that transgender individuals are far more likely to be victims of assault than non-transgender people, including at schools with prescriptive bathroom policies. Opponents of the bill have repeatedly said that there have been no incidents of transgender students in Iowa harassing their peers or misbehaving in bathrooms over the last 15 years, and have noted that Iowa schools have been able to provide accommodations without issue. Holt countered that he knows of six school districts, which he would not name, that have expressed concerns, and claimed school superintendents are begging for guidance on the issue. He added he's not interested in waiting until a child is raped in a restroom by someone pretending to be transgender. Democrats contend it's another in a growing attack this legislative session on transgender Iowans that would paint the state as unwelcoming and exacerbate Iowa's workforce recruitment and retention issues. House Minority Leader Jennifer Confirst, a Democrat from Windsor Heights, said forcing students into bathrooms that don't match their gender identity puts their safety at risk, and notes it is already illegal to enter a restroom to harm someone or invade someone's privacy. Confirst said the legislation is another way of singling out transgender students and equated the bill to state-sponsored bullying. Holt said he empathizes with transgender students uncomfortable using a facility that doesn't correspond with their gender identity. He said accommodations should be made when possible to keep that child comfortable. However, that should not be done at the expense of the privacy and safety of our daughters. North Carolina was thrust into the national spotlight in 2016 for passing similar legislation, which was subsequently partially repealed. The bill sparked a nationwide backlash, causing far-reaching political and economic damage. Doug Newman, executive director of the Cedar Rapids Metro Economic Alliance, said that while the economic impact of such legislation is hard to measure, Iowa businesses have already seen impacts on workforce. We've been far more engaged in discussions in recent years, particularly on social issue bills that have a direct impact on businesses and their workplaces, Newman said in a statement. We strongly encourage legislators, employers, and citizens to advocate policies that are welcoming to all populations and encourage people to come to and stay in Iowa. We can't afford to lose workers or make it any harder than it already is to attract talent. A record 29 unique pieces of LGBTQ legislation were introduced already this legislative session, said Keenan Crow, a lobbyist with LGBTQ activist group One Iowa. That, Crow said, compares to 28 related bills introduced during the two-year General Assembly of 2021-22. Turning now to the Insight page, the guest editorial today is a reprint from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Accord could vastly improve ocean's chance of survival. There's hope yet for planet Earth. Representatives of 70 nations, along with oil companies and major shipping lines, have agreed in principle on a plan to stabilize oceans, limit exploitation, and preserve habitats for marine life. That might not seem like much of a big deal for landlocked Missourians, but there's not a place on Earth that doesn't depend one way or another on the health of the world's oceans and the abundance they provide. And they are dying rapidly, threatening to take the rest of the world with them. It's remarkable in itself that UN members, who rarely agree on anything, have been able to reach a framework for protecting the oceans from further human-made harm. The oceanic areas mapped out for protection belong to no country. That means no country has an automatic right to exploit marine life or mineral riches beneath the sea floor. Conversely, no nation has an automatic right to tell any other nations that they may or may not do what they may or may not do where no nation holds jurisdiction. That's why the only way to protect the oceans is for all nations to agree that this is necessary for the good of the world. U.S. Climate Envoy John Kerry, fresh from an international meeting in Panama, stated earlier this month that a series of meetings that began in 2014 have culminated in the current draft agreement, in which countries around the world have committed to abide by 1,800 specific measures, carrying a price tag of more than $100 billion to address global climate change, sustainable fisheries, maritime security, marine pollution, and areas where species survival is under threat. Without regulation, industrial fishing fleets from countries like China fan out thousands of miles from their own shores to catch, process, and package massive quantities of marine life for consumer markets. They are fishing the oceans to death. When careless people throw plastic bottles into a gutter or stream, or when the streets flood and sweep away all the scattered litter, or when a massive tsunami or hurricane washes away entire coastal towns, that debris makes its way into the oceans. Literal floating islands of debris, plastic, wood, furniture, car parts, and insulation foam have formed an ocean on ocean surfaces, with one garbage patch in the Pacific reported to be the size of the state of Texas. They block off sunlight and choke off life for the creatures below. The agreements reached in Panama set a low bar, conserving only 30% of the ocean by 2030, and all that is conditional on a treaty, which could take years more to negotiate and more years to win legislative ratification. As Americans learned with the Paris Climate Accord, all it takes is one change of U.S. administration to scuttle everything. So, even at 30%, this is by no means a slam dunk. And that is a reprint again from the St. Louis Dispatch. The syndicated columnist contribution today by Tyler Cohen is titled AI is About to Transform Childhood. With the introduction of GPT-4 and Claude, AI has taken another big step forward. GPT-4 is human level or better at many hard tasks, a huge improvement over GPT-3.5 from only a few months ago. Yet amid the debate over these advances, there has been very little discussion of one of the most profound effects of AI large language models. How will they reshape childhood? In the future, every middle-class kid will grow up with a personalized AI assistant, so long as the parents are okay with that. As for the children, most of them will be willing, if not downright eager. In the near future, such friends will be quite real, albeit automated, and they will talk back to our children as directly as we wish. Recent developments suggest that AI models can be both commoditized and customized more easily and cheaply than expected, so parents will be able to choose what kind of companion they want their kids to have. In contrast to the free-for-all of the internet, the available services likely will include education and tutoring, text or vocalizations of what the family pet might be thinking, dancing cartoon avatars, and much more. Companies will compete to offer products that parents think will be good for their kids. Some of the AIs might even read bedtime stories. In fact, I've already heard some of them. Many parents will be reluctant to let their kids become attached to an AI, but I predict that most families will welcome it. For one, parents will be able to turn off the connection whenever they wish. Simply clicking a button is easier than yanking an iPad out of a kid's grasp. Most of all, letting your kid have an AI companion will bring big advantages. Your child will learn to read and write much faster and better, and will do better in school. Or maybe you want your kid to master Spanish or Chinese, but you can't afford an expensive tutor who comes only twice a week. Do you want your child to learn how to read music? The AI services will be as limited or as expansive as you want them to be. It is an open question how quickly schools will embrace these new methods of learning. At some point, however, they will become part of the curriculum. Competitive pressures will make parents reluctant to withhold AI from their kids. Of course, children will use these AIs for purposes far beyond what their parents intend. They will become playthings, companions, entertainers, and much more. What about teenagers? Well, many parents may allow their kids to speak with AI therapists. It might be better than nothing, and perhaps better than many human therapists. It is easy enough to imagine the problems. Socially conservative parents won't be able to stop their kids from visiting friends whose AIs teach about sex education. Many kids may manage to jailbreak their AIs, getting them talking about sex and violence, even in an educational context. Try Roman history. And while the rise of AI won't necessarily increase inequality, it's hard to argue that it won't confer even more advantages on wealthy and middle-class kids. But the biggest drawback might simply be that the AI services work too well, and kids become very attached, neglecting friends and family. They might be good babysitters that parents won't always pull the plug when they should. They might, in short, be the 21st century version of television. What will it be like to grow up with such companions? Nobody really knows, but an entire generation is about to find out. And that's by Tyler Cohen, who is a Bloomberg Opinion columnist. One community letter today is titled, "Education Pick Has No Public Education Experience." In case there was still doubt in anyone's mind concerning our governor's feelings about public education, her choice to head the state's Department of Education says it all. The last time Chad Aldis was directly involved in a public school was when he graduated from high school. He has degrees in economics and law and has worked primarily as a consultant and lobbyist concerning education policy in Florida and Ohio. He has never worked in any position in a public school. However, he is a vocal advocate for school choice and voucher systems, two concepts dear to our governor's heart. Also, two concepts that have very little research indicating that they are particularly effective in increasing the level of education for comparable student groups. But with our governor and her supporters in the legislature, improving education in our state isn't nearly as important as placating her donors. So now we have someone leading our Department of Education who falls in line with her political philosophy, someone who has no idea what public education in the state is all about. What could possibly go wrong? That's signed today by Gary Warner from Cedar Rapids. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Friday, March 17, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now we turn to today's obituary page. Just one short notice from Independence. Agnes L. Zimmerly, age 90, died Friday, March 10, Reef Family Center, Independence. From Cedar Rapids, David R. Bowers, age 59, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Monday, March 6th. A celebration of life will be held from 1 to 4 p.m. Sunday, April 30, at Chappie's in Cedar Rapids. Also from Cedar Rapids, Joyce LaVon Divicki, 94, passed away Wednesday, March 15, at Northbrook Manor Care Center. A private funeral service will be held at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories, with burial taking place in the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. You can leave an online condolence at cedarmemorial.com. From Shellsburg, George L. Grovert, age 81, passed away at home March 15. Visitation will be from 2 to 5 p.m. Sunday, March 19th at Trinity Lutheran Church in Vinton. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, March 20 at Trinity Lutheran Church with the Reverend Stephen Preuss officiating. Lunch will be served after the service. Burial services will follow lunch at St. John Lutheran Cemetery, rural Newhall. Memorials can be made in his honor to Trinity Lutheran or the Vinton Lutheran Home, and online condolences left at phillipsfuneralhome.com. From Kelowna, Edward Yoder, age 91, passed away Wednesday, March 15, following a short battle with cancer. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, March 21, at the East Union Mennonite Church on 560th Street near Kelowna. Burial will follow the service. Visitation will be from 3 to 7 on Monday, March 20, at the East Union Mennonite Church. The family requests that memorial donations be to the East Union Mennonite Church, Kelowna Volunteer Fire Department, Kelowna First Responders, or Pleasant View Home Building Fund. The Betty Petersine Funeral Home is assisting the family. From Winterset, Brian Malone, age 70, formerly of Manchester, passed away Tuesday, March 14th at Madison County Memorial Hospital in Winterset. Visitation will be held from 3 to 6 p.m. Sunday, March 19th at Bonenkamp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Manchester. Mass of Christian burial will be from 11 a.m. Monday, March 20, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Manchester. Additional visitation from 10 to 11 a.m. at the church. Burial will take place at St. Mary's Catholic Cemetery in Masonville. Bonenkamp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Manchester is in charge of arrangements. And from Lyle, Illinois, Margene Mary Mice, née Holobar, a resident of Lyle, Illinois, formerly of Solon and Naperville, Illinois, died peacefully on Tuesday, March 7, at Villa St. Benedict in Lyle. That's a senior living center. Her family was by her side. Visitation was held on Thursday, March 16, and was followed by a mass of Christian burial at Saints Peter and Paul Catholic Church in Naperville. Interment is at the Saints Peter Paul Cemetery. Arrangements are by the Friedrich Jones Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Naperville. You may see a complete obituary at www.friedrich-jones.com. Turning now to the sports page, NCAA men's basketball tournament time. Auburn shows Iowa another early exit. For the second straight year, Iowa was eliminated from the NCAA men's basketball tournament on Thursday of the first week. The Hawkeyes were defeated by Auburn 83-75 in Legacy Arena last night, closing their season with a 19-14 record and losses in their final three games. Iowa shaved a 17-point second-half deficit to 66-62 with 4 minutes and 10 seconds left, but the Tigers scored the next 4 points and never led by as little as 6 points again. The first half was a slog for the Hawkeyes. They missed all 9 of their 3-pointers and didn't attempt a 10th in the final 6:48 of the half. It wasn't as if Auburn was torching Iowa from deep, going 1 of 9 for 3 in the half. The Tigers, however, turned the ball over just 3 times. Iowa had just 2 points off turnovers and 2 second chance points. That, coupled with the shooting, made for the 5-point deficit. Philip Rabraka had 10 points in the half. Chris Murray scored 4, but didn't score again in the half, missing 4 three-pointers. Iowa was 7 of 27 from the 3-point range and couldn't make up for it. Connor McCaffrey got the Hawkeyes' first 3 when he beat the shot clock with 18:38 left to cut Auburn's lead to 35-29. His team didn't score again for 3 minutes. Reserve guard Trey Donaldson, who came in averaging 2.1 points had made 8 three-pointers all season, sank 3 in a row in the space of 1 minute and 40 seconds. The Hawkeyes within 64-60 with 5 minutes left. Getting any closer was not to be. And for the Hawkeye women, the last time Iowa made a deep run, a really deep run, in the NCAA women's basketball tournament, the Hawkeyes felt they reached their full potential. It was the Elite Eight in 2019, and a teary Megan Gustafson said when it was over that the Hawkeyes in reality reached about every goal we could. That was then. 4 years later, Iowa possesses another dynamite team. This team believes there is no ceiling. If we go out and do what we can do, and if we give it all, I don't think we have any limits, McKenna Warnock said on Thursday. We don't want to settle for the Sweet 16 or the Elite Eight, added Kate Martin. I don't think there's a ceiling with this team. I truly believe in this team. Our potential is as far as we want to go. As testament, Martin scribbled out a tournament bracket earlier this week, and it contained a happy ending. I've got us winning over UConn, she said, with South Carolina and Indiana also in the Final Four. The journey begins with the first round test today at a sold-out Carver Hawkeye Arena. Third-ranked Iowa, 26-6, a 2-seed in the Seattle 4 region, faces number 15-seed Southeastern Louisiana with a record of 21-9. This is why Caitlin Clark came to Iowa. Obviously, the goal is the Final Four, she said, but at the same time, we have to put together 4 good games to get to where we want to be. In sports of area interest today, it is the NCAA championship, and that takes place in Tulsa, Oklahoma at 10 a.m. NCAA tournaments are ongoing, and if you're listening on the radio, you can hear the round-robin coverage starting at 10 a.m. at KGYM. Turning now to the Business 380 page, this story from Washington is titled Congress Seeks Clampdown on U.S. Land Sales to China. Lawmakers in Congress and across the country are sounding national security alarms about foreign buyers, particularly those with links to the Chinese government, acquiring control of U.S. farm and forest land. Members of both parties increasingly see Beijing and the Chinese Communist Party as threats to the U.S. The warnings offer farm state lawmakers an opportunity to advance proposals they have pushed for several years that would treat foreign control of farmland and businesses as national security threats equivalent to those posed by foreign ownership of cutting-edge technology companies and intellectual property. There's also worry that federal security over transactions recorded at a local level, sometimes with only voluntary disclosure of the buyer's homeland, could meet resistance. The result is that legislative efforts that stalled in the 117th Congress are now back on the table, but with no clearer path to passage. One reason controls might have a better chance now is that both sides of the divided Congress appear to be in agreement on China. It's something everybody has an eye on, said Wyoming Agriculture Director Doug Miyamoto, before adding, there's been foreign ownership of U.S. resources for decades. Miyamoto said most farmers and ranchers he's worked with would be wary of giving the federal government more information about private land transactions. Senator John Tester, a Democrat from Montana, said at a February 28 Senate Banking Committee hearing that he supports legislation sponsored by Senator Mike Rounds, a Republican from South Dakota, that would require the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States to review transactions involving agriculture and agriculture biotechnology and block purchasers acting for China, Russia, Iran, or North Korea. Why should we allow them entrance, any entrance, into our country? This legislation is a good thing to have out there, not only for America's national security, but for food security, Tester said. Two deals seem to be driving the current worry. The purchase over 5 years of 140,000 acres in Texas by businesses controlled by a billionaire Chinese real estate developer, with 15,000 acres set aside for a wind farm that would supply the state with electricity. Also, the 2022 purchase by Fufeng Group of 370 acres in Grand Forks, North Dakota, to operate a corn milling operation. Both sites are near U.S. military installations. Chinese ownership of U.S. farmland also grew substantially in 2013 when Shuanghui International Holdings bought Smithfield Foods in a deal that included farms, hogs, equipment, technology, water rights, and intellectual property. Despite such well-publicized purchases, Chinese buyers with 383,935 acres hold less than 1% of foreign-owned U.S. farm, forest, pasture, and non-agricultural land, the Farm Service Agency reported in 2021. Canadian buyers with 12.8 million acres, much of it in Maine woodlands, own far more and top the list of foreign countries with U.S. agriculture holdings. The Farm Service Agency's report said foreign persons and businesses had stakes in about 40 million acres of agricultural land as of December 31, 2021. That's 3.1% of all privately held agricultural land and 1.8% of all land. Turning now to the living section, Move Those Muscles, Mayo Clinic News Network. Years ago, weightlifting was thought to be reserved solely for bodybuilders and athletes. However, there has been significant research on the medical benefits of lifting weights. Everyone benefits from stronger bones and muscles. Plan to incorporate weight training into your routine, regardless of your age, ability, or fitness level. Weight training is a type of strength training that uses weights for resistance. This could be weight machines or free weights, like dumbbells or barbells, at home or at a gym. It stresses and strengthens your muscles over time. Who can benefit from weight training? It doesn't matter if you're 19 or 90, run marathons, or struggle to climb the stairs. Weight training can benefit everyone. It helps build muscle, strengthens bones, improves balance, and prevents injuries. Often it's helpful for people with many chronic health conditions. Overall, it helps people feel better physically and mentally. Weight training has also been shown to help improve blood pressure, blood sugar, brain health, bone density, cholesterol, chronic pain, heart disease, depression, metabolism, self-confidence, thinking and learning skills, and weight management. Here are 10 key points to remember when considering beginning a new weight training routine. Choose your equipment. Many options are available: free weights, hand weights, weight machines, and bands. Some exercises use only your body weight and don't require any equipment. The right choice depends on your budget and preference. Warm up. Cold muscles are more prone to injury, so consider warming up with a brisk walk, 5 to 10 minutes, and dynamic stretching to start each training session. Start light. Start light to moderate weights in the first few sessions. Starting light can prevent muscle soreness and lessen the chance of injury. Increase weight slowly. Gradually increase the amount over a period of 2 to 4 weeks. 10 to 15 repetitions should become difficult as muscles tire and fatigue. Pay attention to pain. Proper weight training should reduce pain, not cause it. If you have sharp or shooting pain, stop doing that exercise. Lift slowly. When lifting weights, do not use momentum. Most weight training injuries occur from swinging the weights, improper technique, or lifting too heavy an amount. Take about 2 seconds to lift the weight and 4 or more seconds to lower it. Training slower activates more muscle fibers in the targeted muscle, which will increase the benefits of strength training in the end. Build in rest. Work your muscles to fatigue on each exercise and then rest them for at least 48 hours. Lift weights 2 to 3 days a week for each muscle group. Seek variety. A good weight training program should include at least 8 to 12 different exercises and should target the major muscles of the legs, back, chest, abdomen, arms, and shoulders. Focus on one set. Do at least one set in each exercise, paying attention to your form. Most people get results by doing one set of 10 to 15 reps for each exercise. Previously, researchers recommended at least 2 to 3 sets, but recent research states that one set done properly can be just as effective. And breathe. Remember always to maintain your breathing while you lift. Breathe out through the hardest part of the exercise. If you're new to weight training, talk with a personal trainer or another member of your healthcare team about the best weight training exercise for you, and then learn about proper form and technique to avoid injury. And this from the Tribune News Service, what's the best source of vitamin C besides fruit? As promised for the celebration of National Nutrition Month, our first installment of questions from readers. Question: I would like to get more natural vitamin C from foods. I have a condition called stomach dumping and also heartburn. Juicy sweet fruits cause digestive distress and heartburn. I take a 500 milligram ester C tablet each day. Could you please suggest some foods that contain vitamin C but that are not sweet, acidic, or juicy? How much should I eat daily? The answer: the recommended daily allowance of vitamin C is currently 75 milligrams for adult women. And while many people like yourself take higher doses from supplements, it's certainly possible to meet your vitamin C needs from food. One Sun Gold kiwi fruit, for example, contains 131 milligrams of vitamin C. 3/4 of a cup of orange or grapefruit juice offers about 95. If you can tolerate juicy fruits, you can also get vitamin C in a red or green bell pepper. 1/2 cup cooked broccoli or strawberries. 1/2 cup of Brussels sprouts or even a medium baked potato. Although high doses of vitamin C appear to be safe, they can trigger digestive distress, especially if you exceed the current upper intake of 2,000 milligrams a day set by the Institute of Medicine's Food and Nutrition Board. Also from the Mayo Clinic News Network, does one moldy berry spoil the whole bunch? This by Dee Dee Stipen. Spring's around the corner, which means the beginning of berry season. Berries can be a great source of potassium and vitamins C and K, and can also promote a healthy gut. While berries are among the healthiest foods to eat, if not stored properly, they can get mushy and grow mold. But a little bit of mold doesn't necessarily mean the whole batch goes to waste. In this Mayo Clinic Minute, a pediatric infection disease expert answers the question, does one bad berry spoil the whole bunch? Molds are very common in our environment, and they tend to thrive in areas where there's a lot of moisture and organic material. Berries especially can develop a white coating on them that kind of looks like cotton or fuzz. A few moldy berries doesn't mean you have to throw out the whole batch. To throw out one that looks visibly moldy as well as any that might have been in direct contact is a better option. If more than about a quarter of the berries are moldy, you're probably best to get rid of all. But if the rest are looking healthy, they're not bruised, they're not soft, and there's no visible mold, they're okay to eat after you've washed them well. If you don't notice the mold until you've already started eating, there's no need to panic. It's unlikely to make you sick if you consume a small amount of mold. If you eat a large amount, there's a chance you could get some digestive-type symptoms. Stomach ache, nausea, vomiting, that's pretty common. You'd have to eat quite a few of the mold to feel ill. To keep your berries fresher and mold-free longer, rinse them with vinegar and water and store them on a dry paper towel in an open container in your fridge. On the comic page, this submitted by Sam Scott from Vernon, Connecticut, in the Pluggers column. Pluggers wear their green flannel shirts today, and the photo is of a green flannel shirt with the gentleman holding a shamrock. Dear Abby, today, Grandma sniffs at young woman's nose stud. Dear Abby, my 20-year-old niece Andrea came to visit her grandmother wearing a nose stud. Andrea is quiet, is polite to her grandparents and aunt, and is in her third year of college. Her grandmother is livid at her daughter for allowing the girl to do this. Her grandmother is footing the bill for her college. It appears Andrea may be trying to rebel at this age. Who can help the grandmother to get her grandmother to stop this behavior, and how? Andrea has never done anything like this before, and this is not like her. Her friends don't look or act like goths or punks. This is so out of character. She earns good grades and is usually a quiet girl who never speaks to anyone other than her mom or brothers. Please advise. Signed, Taken Aback in New York. And the answer? Dear Taken Aback, you keep referring to your niece as a girl. Allow me to enlighten you. This girl is a young woman, and that's all in capitals. If Granny has a bone to pick with Andrea about her choice of jewelry, she should discuss it with her instead of railing against her fashion choice behind her back. From my perspective, this is a tempest in a teapot. Let it blow over. And that's today's Dear Abby. Closing with the weather today, St. Patrick's Day, chilly and blustery, with highs expected only to reach the upper 20s in Cedar Rapids. It will be the coldest March 17 since 1993, when the high was 23. Dubuque and Waterloo saw their coldest St. Patrick's Days in history that year, topping out at 20 and 18, respectively. Cedar Rapids' coldest ever St. Patrick's Day was in 1941, when the high was only 15 degrees. Iowa City's record fell the same year, topping out at 16. The warmest March 17 in Cedar Rapids was a more recent one, topping out at a whopping 82 degrees back in 2012. And the snowiest St. Patrick's Day was 1984, when 3.5 inches of snow fell. The average for today is 47 for a high and 27 for a low. And again, that record high of 82 was set in 2012. The record low of 2 below zero was set in 1902. Look for the same type of weather tomorrow, with the sun breaking through on Sunday and Monday. We're in the waning crescent moon phase, with moon rise at 5:55 a.m. and moon set at 3:35 p.m. Sunset tonight is at 7:16 p.m., sunrise tomorrow at 7:13 a.m. That gives us 12 hours and 2 minutes of daylight. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, March 17. Happy St. Patrick's Day. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening, and have a great, safe day.